Hi, this is Beth Golay. Before we get started with my conversation with Zakiya Dalila-Harris, here's a message from one of our other podcasts.
It's mailbag day on the latest You're Saying It Wrong podcast as we dip into some listener questions, including one that has us revisit a topic from an earlier episode that proves both Bob Dylan and Eric Clapton are indeed saying it wrong. You're Saying It Wrong. Find it at KMUW.org, through the KMUW app, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Zakiya Dalila-Harris has written a thriller set in the publishing industry. I know, words you don't expect to hear in the same sentence, but her novel, The Other Black Girl, is just that. The idea came to Harris when she was working as an editorial assistant and then as an assistant editor at one of publishing's largest houses. She realized that she was one of only two black women working there. Combine that realization with the love for the movie Get Out, and you have a thriller set in the publishing industry on your hands. I recently spoke with Zakiya Dalila-Harris about The Other Black Girl and, believe it or not, the movie The Blob. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's that conversation. So, people are describing your book as, you know, The Devil Wears Prada meets Get Out. Is that how you would describe it? Or, I mean, how did you pitch it?
Yeah, you know, pitching it was interesting because comps are hard. I worked in publishing before and comps were hard for me then, and they get harder, I think, when it's your own baby. But yeah, Get Out was definitely in mind for me. Really big influence. I just loved the genre element, and I feel like this book's genre element, if I may be so bold, works in a similar way of talking about certain topics while also keeping the reader kind of visually, or I guess with the book, well, visually, the words, kind of in it, in the story. So Get Out, but then I also think, I mean, Devil Wears Prada, totally, but for me, I think more of kind of Stepford Wives, like Rosemary's Baby, but those are older, so it's not, I think, something that would be outward facing in terms of sales, but I think the slow burn of those is really kind of what I was trying to go for with the tension between Nella and Hazel. So trying to find the balance between that was very tricky though.
So the book is titled The Other Black Girl. Can you give us a brief description without, you know, spoilers? I'm sure you have this one down pat.
Yeah. So The Other Black Girl follows Nella Rogers. She is a young editorial assistant who has been the only Black person working at Wagner Books for the last 2 years. And Wagner Books is a very prestigious, very white publishing house set in Midtown, the heart of Midtown, where we all love to be. And so Nella's working at Wagner, really tired, exhausted, but trying to work her way up when Hazel, another young Black woman, starts working in the cubicle next to hers. And Nella is so excited. Finally, she has someone to kind of share the burden with in a lot of ways of not being the only Black person, not having to speak for everyone. But very quickly, things start to get very weird in the office. And Nella starts to wonder Hazel's intentions, I'll just say. And then also, I should also add that unfolding alongside Nella's story are the stories of three other Black women who are all tied to the world of media, the world of publishing as well. And they're all tied also to a secret that has implications for Black people all over the world.
So you mentioned that you worked in publishing. You were at Doubleday, Knopf, and those are imprints of Random House. And so you were first an editorial assistant and then an assistant editor. Can you talk to me about how that time informed this novel and how you transitioned from publishing to writing?
Yeah. I mean, I was in that space. I was an editorial assistant for 2 years and then got promoted to assistant editor. And I was in that world not that long, I think it seems like. But when you're there for even just a few months, it is like, it is a vibe. It is a space. I still have publishing in me, I think, from just those couple, 2.5, 3 years. And I loved a lot of it. I think Nella's love of editing and the things about the job that she does like, those are things that I loved. I loved the cover conversations, the lingo. It's just so, it's just not unlike anything else. But of course, there's also the side that is steeped in, frankly, old-fashioned ways. The fact that I was one of two Black people working in this space at the time I was there. I was the only Black woman in editorial the entire time. Like, that was weird to me. And also weird that like no one really felt, I mean, people felt like we should do something about it. A lot of the younger people did. We had, you know, conversations, we had meetings, but it often felt like the younger people were the ones like who had to do most of the work, even though, you know, we didn't have that much time to do it. And it wasn't only young people, I won't say. There were, of course, some older, higher up people as well. But so all of those feelings, those emotions, you know, loving this idea of working in publishing, but not loving the foundation of it, were at war in my mind. And so I really wanted to show what that's like for someone like Nella, who kind of had this romantic idea of working in publishing, wants to be the Black editor at Wagner Books, but all these factors are just like weighing really heavily on her. But thankfully, my experiences were not nearly as drastic as Nella's were.
So I understand that you weren't necessarily targeting the publishing industry, that this book could have been set in any industry, but instead you had Black women in mind as your target audience. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel for a lot of my life growing up, I've felt like this kind of anomaly, or like I've trying to find my place in the world is something that took me a while, I think. I grew up in mostly white spaces. I didn't really get a group of like true Black girlfriends until I got to college. And like that for me was such a game changer. But having that background made me feel like I wasn't quite in this world, wasn't quite in that world, you know what I mean? And so being in this space that I felt really until Issa Rae was doing her thing, I didn't really see that much of on TV or in culture a lot. So I wanted to write a book for people like me, Black women like me, who, you know, even if they haven't grown up in mostly white spaces, like we all know what that struggle is to feel like we have to code switch, to feel like we have to kind of adapt and maybe squash parts of ourselves. Like I've had conversations with so many Black women about hair in the office, about how they felt pressured to wear their hair a certain way or to speak a certain way. And so all of these things, I felt like there were people out there who had similar experiences. At least I hoped. When you're writing, you don't know, but the reception's been great so far, so from other Black readers. So,
can you talk to me about the importance of Black hair? Because throughout this book, hair is the subject of so many conversations, and I'm not asking what 4C hair is, but I am wondering, would you say that natural hair provides freedom? I mean, talk to me about liberty in terms of hair.
You know, I think that it provides freedom depending on who you are, if you're natural. I mean, that was the case for me. I think I completely understand why someone would relax their hair, why they would straighten their hair. It makes sense. I just know for me personally, the reasons I was doing it was because I wanted to have hair like my white friends. I wanted to look like them. And I mean, at the time also when I was younger, like when I started relaxing my hair, like Beyonce had come out and she had really straight hair. Shant, like there were Black women too. The natural hair conversation in 2001 and 2002 is not the same as the one we have now, plus the internet and all of those things. So yeah, I mean, hair is such a big part of the book and such a big part of me. And I really wanted to show just like how this thing that I think seems innocuous to a lot of people is really significant to Black women, even if you don't have the same kind of issues that I had. You still, I think a lot of Black women can understand that feeling of, you know, being compared to a certain standard or feeling like you have to straighten your hair. So I think more so having the being able to choose how you wear your hair is the freedom part. Like, that's freeing. And I'm hoping with, and I think even now with what's going on, I'm hoping that we are seeing that there are many ways to be, like, Black women aren't a monolith. Just like in this book, everyone's got different opinions and different hair and different styles.
So as we mentioned, the title of the book is The Other Black Girl. And as you mentioned, Nella is working at Wagner Publishing for 2 years before Hazel is hired. And one might think that either Nella or Hazel would be referred to by their white colleagues as the other black girl. But there's another reference to other black girls or OBGs in the book. And there was also a point in the book where Nella recalls that her mother used to tell her that one of the most dangerous phrases ever to exist in the English language is one of the good ones. Talk to me a little bit about that, and maybe if you're willing, if you don't think it's a spoiler, who are the other black girls?
Yeah, I can say where the other black girl kind of like that phrase came from, which it came from an inside joke with me and one of my black friends. When we would go to parties and we were the only ones there, we would kind of, you know, look around at who was there. And if we saw another black person, we'd be like, oh, there's the other black girl. And a lot of times it was the same person who was at these parties, because it was when we were in grad school. And like, there's the OBG, but never in like a malicious way. Just in like a, oh, like this person also got to this space and we're here as well. Like, I wonder what that person's about. Or like, I wonder, you know, how do they fit in with this group of people that we're with, like, would they be friends with us, that kind of thing. And so I really wanted to look at not just politics between white people and black people. I think that obviously needs to be explored a lot, and I definitely do that in this book, but I also wanted to look at the way that black people treat each other. We can be harder on each other, frankly, than other people. And I think that comes out of, I mean, there's so many places where that comes from. I won't go into all of them, but a lot of it, I think, stems from this idea that there can only be one of us. Or, you know, we have to kind of elbow the other one out so that we can be there. Because for a lot of places, it seems like just having one person who represents this group, and it goes, I think, to all different kinds of diversity, really, you're checking off boxes. And that can really cause a tension between Black people. And that's why I really wanted the focus to be on Wagner, but also just how that affects what could have been a beautiful friendship. Although I hope I'm not spoiling now.
You know, you mentioned checking off boxes, and there was a section in the book when Nella was reading a manuscript of the house's biggest client, and it had included a less than one dimensional character, and Nella was reflecting on a quote from one of her greatest influencers, and this is a quote, "With heightened awareness of cultural sensitivity comes a great responsibility. If we're not careful, diversity might become an item people start checking off a list and nothing more. A shallow, shadowy thing, but with one dimension." You know, so many times Nella witnessed white people half-heartedly striving at diversity and completely missing the mark. How do you think she was able to push past this even when she felt defeated? You know, it just felt like there were so many times that Nella was, you know, beaten down, yet she kept going. What do you think she possessed that allowed her to do that?
Yeah, you know, I think about myself a lot with that aspect, because, you know, I've worked in so many different places, and it can be really hard to kind of figure out, you know, how much of this is me and how much of this is what's happening around me, and is it worth it? Do I want to hang in there in the hopes that I can make a change? And with Nella, that's I think the biggest thing she's holding on to is the fact that, okay, once I get through this mess, these microaggressions, all of these things, I just need to get a little more power, a little more leverage, and then eventually I will be able to be the one calling the shots. And that's the dream. And I think that's something a lot of people can relate to, of the sense like, okay, it's this hazing. I have to go through this hazing and then I will be able to make it through. And when you think about publishing, just how few people of color, how few Black people make it into publishing, Nella felt this responsibility in a way. And it's not healthy, and it is healthy for other people. And it's like, how do I, you know, navigate that too, of like, do I sacrifice my day to day in order to hopefully one day make this company reflect, properly reflect the country? So those are all things that propel Nella and then also lead to what happens, I think, in the book. And I think everybody case by case has to kind of draw a line, and but it's not that easy. I think everyone has their own opinion on what the best way to really survive in these spaces is. And you never know what the outcome's gonna be.
You know, I'm gonna throw more of your words back at you here. So there was one point in the book when Nella was visiting with Richard, and he was impressed that she had often visited the Center for British Art at Yale. And she said, "It might have sounded peculiar, but it was in seemingly mundane moments like those when she told a white man something so basic about herself that made his eyes boggle out of his head, that she felt closest to all the Black people who were Black long before she was. All of the enslaved Black men and women who impressed white people with their reading abilities. All of the Black men and women who became doctors and lawyers and other things people said they couldn't. Anyone who had impressed a white person simply by existing, which, given the number of times Black people had been lynched and raped and beaten down over the last 400 years, should have been every Black person." You know, I read that on the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder. And, you know, we saw so many large protests, and it seemed like we were, like we might actually see meaningful change. But does it feel like we've just lost momentum and intensity, and we're back where we started a year ago?
I mean, it really depends on when you talk to me about it. I agree. I mean, I'm glad you read that quote, because I also, in that moment, I really wanted to get at my connection that I feel to other Black people before me, of my parents, their parents, but then also going all the way back to when my ancestors were brought here. And just how there is so much pain in the past, and so much recurring pain of the same, I mean, things, some things get better and then things seem to revert back. But then there are also, there is this joy and this pride I feel in the fact that I am still here. And those two things, I think often for me, like I was talking about working in a space and trying to figure out, is this worth it? Like, this is for a greater good. I think also relate to this, because I do feel hopeful. I think it's hard not to. Conversations like these, and even just publishing's reception of the book has made me feel hopeful, and the conversations that are what might come from it. But I think also it's hard. I think I talk about performative allyship in the book, and how even things like when I wrote that part, it was before last year. So in my mind, Eric Garner was in my mind, Philando Castile was in my mind. So that was really the thinking behind it. And I just remember how there was a swell of, we need to do better, but then that kind of went away, right? And then last year we had what we had, and the momentum is kind of going away again. So I don't know. I think until people are back to a more normal space, like when people are in the office talking to one another face to face, I think that's when things are going to change, at least in publishing and hopefully everywhere, because I mean, things are not where they should be. We're so far from that. And I'm trying to stay positive.
So Kendra Ray Phillips and Diana Gordon are some of Nella's biggest influences throughout her career. Yet they are fictional characters. Who are some of your influences?
Yeah, I think from like a career perspective, I was very aware of Toni Morrison's time working as an editor, and then writing, definitely an influence. Octavia Butler, blowing the roof off of expectations for authors. I mean, the fact that she was able to occupy that space and like just was amazing and prolific and still was able, she had so much to give in a time that's not, I mean, 2021 is not that much better, but it's better, right? And so I find a lot of inspiration from her. And then current people, I mean, Britt Bennett, Raven Leilani, like other Black women who are writing complicated characters who are sometimes pretty messy. I love that. More of that, please.
I'm curious about your use of perspective and point of view. I mean, how do you decide who gets the first person voice and when to use third person limited?
Yeah. You know, I started this book with just Nella, actually, which I feel like is important to note because it was just third person close throughout, no one else's perspectives. And looking back on it, I'm like pretty sure I did that third person because Nella is so much me, if you can't tell by us talking, that I think I needed that added layer of distance. And also these topics are just really hard to write about from first person. I mean, all of the first person sections were still pretty difficult, but especially the scenes with Nella feeling so worn down, feeling tired, all of those emotions are a lot. And I hoped while doing it from third person that, you know, what Nella's life is, her perspective is, it can be hard sometimes, I think, having all of these microaggressions thrown at you as a reader, but I hope that the third person kind of allows you a little more space as well. So that was my thinking with her. And then Diana, Kendra Ray, and Shani, those sections actually came after I'd written one full draft of the book. They were all in the book in different ways, but they just didn't pop the way that I wanted them to. And once, the more I gave them space to appear on the page, once I did that, I felt like I really saw the full story because I didn't want to just tell it from Nella's kind of romanticized view of Kendra Ray and Diana, because I think what happens in their relationship is really important for at least the reader to know, because it goes into how much has changed, but how much hasn't changed, which is another theme of the book. So that was really my thinking behind the perspectives, but I also just, I love writing first person, but I just didn't want to do it for a whole book too. That's like another very honest reason.
You know, you mentioned that you wrote all of Nella first, and I was, you might have already answered this, but you know, the book gracefully evolves into a thriller. I mean, it's not obvious from the beginning that that's where it's headed. Did you originally set out to write a thriller, or did that pivot after you had begun the writing process?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. I don't think I called it a thriller in my head. I knew that there would be Nella and Hazel and this tense relationship between the two of them, because I was really thinking about them at the core. But I also knew how it was gonna end. And I also knew that Nella would be receiving notes, mysterious notes, which is in the copy in the book, so I'm not spoiling it. I was just like, wait a second. So I knew those were things were happening. And then the more I wrote, the more I was like, okay, wait, but if you're gonna get to like point B and point C, like you're gonna need, this is a thriller. Like just accept it. You're going into this territory. And that happened pretty quickly. And I just loved it. I had so much fun. And then I also started rereading different kind of parts of books. I didn't read full books, but I actually did reread Kindred, which in some ways is pretty thrilling, I think. And that really helped.
Okay, so now this is a bit of a departure. We have a debate going on at the station, and I hope you'll weigh in on it. I'm going to play a piece of audio. This is my colleague, Fletcher Powell, and it's just 22 seconds long to give you an idea of when it's going to end.
Okay.
My boss recently informed me that The Blob, that 1958 science fiction classic, is, I believe she said, a bad movie. Aside from its outsized impact on popular culture, The Blob has the distinction of being the very first movie I ever saw, so you can imagine this is a bit of a touchy subject for me. But beyond that, The Blob is not, in fact, a bad movie, but is what a person might call good.
So, what do you think? How about you? Is Fletcher right? We know how Nella feels.
You know what's so funny about this is I was home recently. So let me give a little backstory. I love this. I'm a big horror fan. So like this is my territory. So I saw The Blob for the first time when I was like 12 or 13 with my dad. My dad and I would watch a lot of those old 50s horror movies. And I'd say it's so bad, it's so good. That's really why I love it. We tried to show it to, I have two little sisters, and they were not having it. They were making fun of it the entire time. But Steve McQueen is just so fun to look at. And then the Jell-O blob. But the thing I will say, to tie this back, I mean, I don't know if you want me to tie this back to the book.
It's fine, yes.
But the thing I'll say about The Blob that I really love is the end. The end of the movie, once they fly it out into Antarctica, then because the cold, they discover, this isn't a spoiler, but you're welcome. You might enjoy it more knowing. The cold is what kills it. So they bring it out to Antarctica and they think, okay, we're done. But then the words, the end, turn into a question mark. And you wonder, I don't know if there was a blob to you, but you wonder what's going to happen. And I really wanted the end of this book to have a question mark like that. I think that's, I mean, I don't still talk about The Blob like that, but there are other movies that I do talk about like that, where they leave it open. And so with The Other Black Girl, that's, I was channeling that energy, I think, with my finale.
So we've covered a lot in a short amount of time. Is there anything you want to talk about that I haven't asked?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, possibly, but I also have loved every bit of this.
Good. I'm glad.
That was Zakiya Dalila Harris, author of the novel The Other Black Girl, which was published by Atria Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and our producer is Haley Krausen. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.